Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Stephanie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker and will believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I just had the pleasure of meeting our speaker, John C., and I'm really excited to hear what he's got to say.
Hi, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 9th, 2016. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I have a sponsee, and I don't know if my sponsor has a sponsor, but I like to keep it simple. So I was born in Lexington, Massachusetts, which is right outside of Boston. And for you history buffs, it's the birthplace of the Revolutionary War. Our town did this reenactment every year where all the American soldiers lined up and Paul Revere rode through, and then the British soldiers came and they just slaughtered all the Americans. And the end of it is that everybody would come screaming out of their houses, crying over their dead loved ones. And then I guess it's like the reenactment went to Concord, and then you could watch us win a battle, but since I was from Lexington, I never went to that one. My parents were still married, were Catholic, and my mom and dad met at Harvard, and Bill Clinton wrote my mother's Harvard recommendation letter because she was his intern, and I have two older brothers. In my home, I did a lot of the normal, like, manly, masculine things. Like, I played every sport, and like any young, effeminate man, I steadily quit every single one of them over time. I quit baseball, and then hockey, and then basketball, and then soccer, and by the time I'd gotten to high school, I decided what I really wanted to do was drink. And I started getting in trouble. I would get suspended from school. I would flunk out of classes. And I remember my first drink was actually at my first communion when I was 8 years old. And I just remember going up to, we called a Eucharistic minister, and she handed me the wine. And this is supposed to be Jesus's blood, and I just started chugging it. Everyone in my family told me that I wouldn't like the taste of it, so I was determined to taste it and like it. So maybe I just started off on the wrong foot. And the first time I blacked out from drinking, I was 14 years old. It was my mother's birthday party. And I started puking red wine everywhere. And my brother found me, and he freaked out. He thought I was puking blood. And I just remember being bedridden, hungover the next day, and just thinking, like, this is it. I'm going to do that again. And growing up, my home was kind of violent. My dad was pretty physically abusive. He used to, like, beat the crap out of us. And he would, like, lock me in the shed, and he would beat me with a metal pole. And my brothers were also very violent. The police used to come to our house, and so did child services. And my mom would always, like, rehearse the lies that I had to say. And it would start with, like, I would have a bruise down the side of my face, and I would be told that, you know, my mom would hold an ice pack to it and say, like, okay, tomorrow you go to school, you say that you got hit by a ball at soccer practice. And, you know, I was told that if I didn't say these things, then I wouldn't get to have all the nice, rich kid things that I had. I wouldn't get to ride horses anymore. I wouldn't have a TV in a foster home. you know, like, my parents gave me everything, and this is what I had to do to maintain it. And after my middle brother got arrested the second time, it was for assault, and, you know, there was never violence in my home again after that, because his name was in the newspaper, the police had come, everybody in the town knew, and so I started getting kicked out of the house. If I did something that people didn't like, if I said the wrong thing, and I actually kind of liked that, because, you know, I would go off with my troublemaking friends, I got to do whatever I wanted, and eventually I started spending more and more time away from home. I would run away from home. I was right, like, down the street from downtown Boston, and it wasn't hard to get what I wanted. I could get alcohol, and, you know, I did everything else, too, but we'll talk about alcohol today. And I loved drinking. I drank in high school, in school. I drank after school. I would do things that I thought adults did. Like, I would go home from school, and I would, like, draw a bath, and I would, like, make, like, a cocktail for myself and just, like, lay in there for, like, 2 hours getting drunk by myself. And I guess other people my age were doing homework. But, you know, given the people who raised me, like, everyone in my family drank. And I always grew up being told that, like, I was better than other people. Like, we were better than other people. I think that was because my town was, like, super liberal and my family were Republicans. And so we were always different. And, you know, I carried that with me. And when I would be flunking a class, I'd somehow get away with it. I remember my mother found pictures of my chemistry teacher at her bachelorette party, and suddenly I passed chemistry. I still actually don't know anything about chemistry. And, you know, I'm gay, right? I came out to my parents. It was actually very anticlimactic because they told me the problem wasn't that I was gay. It was that I was belligerently drunk and I was 16 years old. And my godparents, my godfather is gay. So I grew up very Catholic, and it wasn't ever an issue because it was set a precedent before me. Because I don't know why God would make me gay and then give me a gay godfather if it was a problem. And as I got older, I would find more and more ways to get into trouble. And I moved in with a girl in college she was a party girl. She would, like, I'm trying to think of a nice way to say this, but she was a jersey chaser, I think is the term. So we used to throw these big parties, and these professional athletes would come to our house, and I never knew who any of them really were, because as I've mentioned, that wasn't a big fandom of mine. But I was definitely in over my head, and I started experimenting with other substances, and when I was 19, I got an offer from a friend who her boyfriend was living on this island, and we supposedly had jobs there, so I got on a boat with her, and I went to go live on this island, and it was a commune. And ultimately, it turned out to be a cult, and I couldn't leave. And they did a lot of drugs there. They were drinking a lot there. There was some sexual stuff that I wasn't comfortable with. And eventually, I, like, was able to sneak off on the boat. I arranged for a ride to pick me up on the mainland, and I said I was just going to the mainland for the day to, like, get some, like, pharmacy items, and really I, like, jumped in this car and was like, drive. And I carried that with me, too. Like, I then thought that I was so traumatized that I needed to drink more. You know, I started drinking in the mornings when I was 19, and I didn't stop. Like, I was a morning drinker at that point. I went to my first detox when I was 19, and that was where I went to my first AA meeting. And, you know, I also self-harmed a lot. And so I wound up in this detox, and I was so mad because I didn't know why I was there. Because they were telling me that I had a drinking problem, And I was like, no, like, I just have, like, a cutting problem. Like, I don't see the problem here. And they were like, well, you were wasted throwing up in a bucket when you showed up in the ER. So, like, you're here in this detox. And they took us to AA meetings. And, of course, I'm in, like, the little hospital gown getting shuffled in my grippy socks down to the cafeteria to go to an AA meeting. And they asked if I would read the traditions. And I kind of read it, and I saw the word God a lot. And I was like, you know, I've just gotten out of a cult. So I was like, I don't know if I really, like, agree with what you guys are selling here. I'd prefer if somebody else read this. And, I mean, these were people who had gone into this institution to bring the meeting. And I was in that institution in hospital gown, and I thought that I was too good to be at the meeting. And I still remember the woman who told her story that night. And she talked about, she was a waitress, and she would drink wine in the morning in the bathroom hiding from her husband. And I just thought that was disgusting. Like, why would someone drink wine in the morning? Because I drank vodka in the morning. And I thought that that was what you did. Or I'd have, like, beer for breakfast, which I thought was fine because they both started with B. And I after that also was told in this institution that I was an alcoholic. And I thought, well, that makes sense. I drink all the time. And so I thought that I needed alcohol. I think that for me, my disease created this delusion in my head that alcohol was the medicine for me. It made me more social. It made me funnier. It made me more confident. I had been a neurotic kid. I would, like, make my bed every day, and if one of my brothers jumped on it, I'd freak out. And I would spend hours in the bathroom getting ready in the morning, and I just had to be perfect all the time. And when I drank, it was suddenly like I was everybody else. And I made friends that way. And, you know, I never had an issue when I was younger because, like, I wouldn't get bullied or anything like that because I was selling drugs and everybody liked me. And I went to college. I, like, moonlighted as an art student. I would work odd jobs. There was a phase where I worked for, like, a custom spray tanning company, and I would, like, serve champagne while these girls would get spray tans for their bridal showers and weddings. And I would drink the champagne, of course. And I somehow scraped by. But the last year of my drinking, I did the same thing every single day. And I would wake up. I had a little Yorkie that I carried around in a purse. And I would take him for a walk. And I would stop at a Starbucks that was nearby. And I'd get coffee. And then I would stop at the liquor store, which was on the way back to my apartment. And then I would try to make it till noon without drinking. My alarm clock went off at 11 a.m. And so that was very challenging for me to get by that 1 hour. And it was the same thing. I would pass out around 1 or 2 p.m. I would wake up again at 5. I would start drinking again. I would go to sleep at 1 or 2 a.m. And then I would wake up at 11 the next day. And every day there was a bigger mess than the day before. And I would spend half the morning trying to clean up. You know, like I said, I was an art student, so there would be all these red stains everywhere, and I didn't know if they were paint or if they were wine or if they were blood, and I would just be scrubbing and cleaning and trying to stop making a mess, but every day I would get wasted and make another one. And that was also just the wreckage of my life. I was hurting people, and I didn't know. And I also was using everything I had to my own advantage to get more alcohol. I was spending other people's money. I was stealing money. I didn't really understand that stealing was wrong. And that's something that I've had to work on a lot since getting sober. And no one in my life trusted me anymore. I thought that they were all just, like, hating on me. And I couldn't accept that, like, I wasn't supposed to, like, vomit in someone's shoes and then talk to them the next day like we were still friends. And eventually, I I went to a treatment center, like a full-stay rehab, which I got kind of bamboozled into it. My mother had called, like, one of those, like, hotlines if you Google, like, what to do with my drunk son. And it pops up a number, and she called it. And then I got a phone call, and it was a place in Palm Springs, and they were saying they were going to fly me out. And I was like, why? And they were like, well, we just heard you've been drinking a lot, and you need some help. And I was like, Palm Springs? I was like, do you guys have a pool? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, but do you guys have, like, a gym, too? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, I looked outside. It was Boston. It was blizzarding. There was snow everywhere. And I was like, heck yeah, I'm coming. And I got on an airplane and flew across the country. The day that I went to rehab, a friend of mine, she overdosed and died. And I luckily wasn't with her that day. But I got a chance she didn't get when I went to rehab. And, you know, I, for all intents and purposes, thought I was going to a spa. My last drink was at the airport on the way to rehab. And then at the layover on the way to rehab, I had two double Bloody Marys. And I remember staring at this and being like, I really hope this isn't my last drink because this is kind of gross. But it was like 7 a.m. and I didn't know what else was appropriate to drink in public at an airport. And I went to treatment. And, you know, it wasn't a spa. It was a recovery program based in the 12 steps. And I thought I would just kind of give it my all. I kind of hoped to get, like, a little bit of recovery, and then I could just return to my life in Boston with, like, a fresh face. And I think I love the chip system we have. I would say I'm a one white chip wonder, but I really only ever got, like, a white NA key tag. And then I think that was, like, the last NA meeting I went to for a couple of years because I started going to AA more. And but, you know, I would pick up these chips, and they were kind of like what I was, like, living for at the time. Like, you'd give me this little medallion and tell me I did a good job. And my rehab had, like, a level system. So, like, if you got off the detox meds, you could go to the gym. And so then it was like you could be a level 4 and go bowling on Fridays if you got a sponsor. And so I got a sponsor while I was in treatment. They took us to an LGBT meeting once a week on Wednesday nights. And I was like, I'm going to get one of these suckers to be my sponsor. Because like any good alcoholic, I knew how to use my defects to my advantage. And, you know, this guy, he had on like a dress shirt, like he'd just come after work, and he had just picked up a year at that meeting and raised his hand to sponsor, and I was like, he's going to be it. And, you know, I asked him, I made sure that the technician from the rehab heard that I'd asked this man. And... you know, he showed up the next day at the treatment center with a 12 and 12 for me, and we started working the steps. And he told me that I needed to read the first 165 pages of the big book by the next time that I saw him, which was 2 days later. And I stayed up all night reading that book. And, you know, the first 165 pages, I was reading it, and I was like, yeah, like, this is all true. Like, this sounds like alcoholism, this disease we've been talking about in rehab. Like, tell me something I don't know. But I was told to, highlight things that I related to and underline words I didn't know. So that's what I did. I, like, actively read this book. And, this guy picked me up. We went to a meeting and, you know, then he was wearing a t-shirt and he was, like, super buff. And I was like, oh shit, I picked a guy that was kind of hot. And he had a sports car. And I was like, maybe this sober thing is kind of cool. Still not sure it's for me, though. I kept telling everybody in rehab that I was going to drink as soon as I left. And I didn't want to go to sober living. It just sounded awful. I didn't like having a roommate. And I wanted to go back to my life. I didn't know where my little dog was. I, like, thought the rehab, like, was awful. And there was a woman there who had her little dog with her at rehab. And I was pissed because I wanted mine. And so my mother told me that if I went to Arkansas to stay with her sister and got some fresh air in the country, that I could have my little dog back and that he'd be there waiting for me. And so I went to Arkansas, and I got to the airport in Palm Springs, And I think to this day that it was a higher power that I didn't stop at that bar and drink, because that had been the plan. But once I knew I was going to Arkansas, I was like, well, like, and it's going to suck if I only have a day when I show up there. Like, right now I have, like, 35, and I just want to keep that. Like, I clung to these days I was collecting. And I had been told that the way that we get time in sobriety is by stacking days one day at a time. So I got to Arkansas, and, you know, my aunt is a lovely woman. She said that I was an evil baby monster. I was stuck in a dry county, and I just feel like any self-respecting gay man from a northern city, I tried to kill myself. And I ended up in a psych ward in Searcy, Arkansas. And it was a bad place. Like, it was a people banging their heads on the wall and screaming and threatening to murder everyone kind of place. And, you know, this had happened when I was in the detox, and it also happened in the rehab, is I would get, like, a nurse who would come up to me while I was eating, and she'd be like, you know, you're just so cute. Like, what are you doing here? And I'd be like, I don't know either. Like, get me out of here. But inevitably, I would say something that warranted me being there. Like, also get these bugs out from under my skin. And then she would be like, okay, I see why you're here. And, you know, that was really my rock bottom. And I was already sober. But I realized that even though I was sober, I didn't know how to live. The idea of being sober was so terrifying to me and so foreign to me, because I started drinking really, really young. And so I knew in that moment that I had a problem. And while I was in rehab, my godfather, who I mentioned before, offered for me to come live in Atlanta. And he said I could come live with him, and it was on one condition. And so for a living, my godfather was a gay pornography producer. And it was like they shot in a city, in a house that was south of the city, but for 1 week every month, they used the guest bedroom in his house, and that was going to be my room. So I had to sleep on an air mattress in the basement for that week. So I had a bedroom 3 weeks out of the month. And, you know, I would hear a lot of stuff going on in the upstairs. And so, like, you could just imagine me, like, reading the big book at the breakfast nook in the kitchen while, like, people are, you know, having sex upstairs, and there's a lot of moaning and a camera crew. And, you know, like, I was told early on that I should avoid emotional entanglements for my first year. And I don't know exactly what that means even to this day, right? But I knew that in my situation that it was time that I started, like, focusing on me. And I shut everything else out. And I focused on this program because everyone in my life had been telling me what a fuck up I was. You know, my parents were saying, like, John, you're out of control. You're having a problem. And they sent me to rehab and blocked my number. And then, you know, all my friends were like, John, you're crazier than us. And then, you know, I had a boyfriend when I went to rehab. And, you know, he didn't think I could get sober. He was also cheating on me, and I just ghosted him and went to treatment, and I left all these people behind, but when I came in the rooms, I wasn't hearing from people like, oh, that guy's going to make it. I actually was told once in a meeting, and when I was doing 90 meetings in 90 days, which I suggest, that a man looked at me, and he was like, you know, you're just so young, and like, as a young gay man, you're just going to miss out on so many exciting things if you decide to stay sober. And I just thought, like, yeah. But I also heard some old-timers telling their stories, and I was like, well, these stories are fucking lame. Because I did a lot of bad things in a short period of time. And so I buckled down. I was told by a sponsor to read the big book cover to cover. And like I said before, I read those first 165 pages and I didn't really relate. It had a section on to wives and to the family afterwards, and my family had blocked my number and I wasn't going to get married to a woman anytime soon. But I read in these stories, I started to hear voices that I related to. And I noticed that there was this sort of like story arc, and that was that, you know, they hit this rock bottom, and then they get sober, and then they get a sponsor, and then they're doing AA, and then they ended up with like fellowship right at the end. And then they're of service. And so I saw these things happening in each story, and I was like, okay, like I've hit rock bottom, and I have a sponsor, and I was like, I guess now I have to do these other things too. And I did 90 meetings in 90 days. I started working the steps. It wasn't hard for me to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I thought that alcohol was magical, and it was all powerful. It was my higher power at the time. And, you know, I started doing things that I didn't really want to do. Like I started going to mass on Sundays. And I'm not a good Catholic, but I just went anyway. And, I was going to meetings, and I actually kind of hated AA, and I hated AA meetings, but, you know, this was the place that I came, and people were telling me, keep coming back. You know, they would say, like, just stay sober for today. And I saw people picking up chips, and I was picking up chips, and I was like, okay, at least I can keep going back here. Like, everybody else is saying, like, John, get out, you're awful, and this place is saying, keep coming. And so I would go to meetings. I went to the Galano Club. That was where my first home group was there. It was their young people's meeting on Sundays, and I was the only, like, person less than 30 that went, and I thought that I was just fulfilling the quota, and I was of service by doing that. And I was told that your home group is where you are of service. And I eventually I settled into the 10 p.m. group there. It was my home group for 4 years. And it met in the upstairs. They had couches, and they had these Christmas lights, and it was usually kind of dim and dark. And the way that the couches were facing, it wasn't like I was staring at everybody the whole time, so I felt like I could share. And, you know, these were a group of people who, like, they knew about the living situation that I was in at the time, and they knew what I had gone through to end up in the rooms. And I would go to other meetings, and I never really felt like sharing, because I'd hear people talk, and they just seemed to, like, really like being sober, and I was so mad. I didn't want to be there, and I hated how happy they were. And I went to a meeting really early on where they read a daily reflections. It's in towards the end of April, and it says, happiness is not the point. And I kind of hated that because I really wanted to be happy. But I also, it's something I've carried with me my entire sobriety, because now that I'm sober, I get to feel every emotion. So at the time, I was really, really angry, and I still get angry sometimes. And, you know, there have been times that I've been happy. They're few and far between, but I've been happy. I get sad. I get excited. And, like, now that I'm sober, I get to feel all those things, and I have to feel all those things. And I don't get to drink, whether my feelings are good or bad. I've been told that feelings are not facts. So I was working the steps. I had a new sponsor that I got at Galano. He was a gay man. And so I was doing my step four. And I remember I had all these resentments, right? Because some of these older gentlemen at Galano had been, like, hitting on me. And I just thought they were so gross and pervy. And my sponsor said, well, you know, you seem to be showing a lot of skin, and you have a lot of tattoos, so maybe you're asking for it. And I thought, I was like, that's kind of weird. I feel like you're not supposed to say that. And then he proceeded to tell me how he had, when he was drinking and using, he had molested someone who was, like, a young man who was a minor. And I started to get a little uncomfortable, right? I was like, why are you telling me this? This is my fourth step. And he was like, well, I want you to know that I've also done bad things. And I was like, never raped anyone. And not like, I mean, anybody can get recover, but, I mean, he said that, and then also told me I was asking for it. So I just started to get a little weirded out. And I had been told in treatment that if you are a gay man, you could ask a lesbian to be your sponsor. And if you're a lesbian, you could ask a gay man to be your sponsor. And that's what I had to do. And I was at a speaker meeting, and I heard a young woman telling her story, And it was pretty messed up. Like, she was talking a lot about self-harm. I just remember, like, some vivid descriptions of blood. And, you know, she had 2 years, and I was like, I want what she has. Because it's by attraction rather than promotion that we're here. And she was on the board for GIKIPA, which is the Georgia Conference for Young People in AA, and I started to get involved in service. I was their merchandise chairperson, which meant that I had to drive a bunch of T-shirts around in the back of my car. And you know, we did these corny things, like we hosted dances and car washes. And I made some friends there that I still have today. And, you know, these are people who aren't all in Atlanta anymore. A close friend of mine from the GIKIPA, she is living in Texas, and she's about to have a baby. And we still keep in touch. I started to meet a lot of other young people this way. Because at first, I thought, like, wow, there's, like, not a lot of young people in recovery. And I started to meet them, because there are. And there's specific meetings you can go to find them. And I think I love that about AA, that there are these specific meetings. There's young people's meetings, there's LGBT meetings, and there's meetings for everything in between and further than that. And so I really started to work the steps. Making amends took me a really long time. I had a sponsor. And I'll say, like, sponsors, sometimes they move away. I was told I should keep a sponsor where I live. I've had sponsors relapse, and I didn't drink. And I've fired sponsors, and I've had sponsors fire me. I mean, sometimes it stinks, and it's hard, but it's, you know, it's a relationship like any other, and, like, it can come and go. What's important is that I'm still here, and I'm sober. And I had a sponsor. She was a librarian. And so we would meet every week, and we read the big book. We read the 12 and 12. We would read these grapevine anthologies, right? So they're these little books, like Emotional Sobriety, I think, is a really popular one. And we read one called Making Amends. We also read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, which was, like, super boring. And so we read Making Amends, and, you know, I had gone through and apologized to people I'd harmed. The woman I was living with in Boston at the time, I used to steal money out of her purse, right? So she was the first amends I made, mostly because she knew that I was sober now, and we had stayed somewhat in touch. So I just, like, you know, put $80 in an envelope and wrote a little letter and sent it to her, and she wrote me a letter back. She'd accepted my amends, and she kept that $80, which I think would make anybody happy to receive in the mail now that I look back on it. But I read this book, Making Amends, and there was this story in there about a girl who went to a prison to make amends to the man that murdered her friend. And I couldn't understand that, because she seemed like the victim. And I'd had so many resentments and people I'd harmed where it was like, I thought I was the victim, and sometimes I really was. But I realized that even if I've been victimized, that was never an excuse for the way that I ended up treating myself by drinking, using, and harming myself. When I had been sober for 2 years, back in Boston, my dad got jumped. He was crossing a street, and some guy almost hit him. They had words. The guy tailed him into an alleyway and then just beat the crap out of him. He ended up in the hospital. And at the time, you know, seeing my dad get beat up is what I always wanted. And then it happened, and I didn't feel any better. And so after that, I guess he was really depressed. He was struggling. My mom told me about it. And I said, I was like, well, like, why don't you just, like, send him to come to Atlanta? Like, he'd come visit me for a couple days. I've learned how to set boundaries with family members. He, you know, stayed in a hotel nearby, and I just, like, for 48 hours just let him into my life a little bit. I didn't make a verbal amends where I told him everything that I was sorry for. I just let him be my dad for 2 days. And he came to the gym with me. We went to the High Museum. He met a good friend of mine and her family. We all went out to dinner. And we wanted to go to the movies, and we went to go see The Lion King, like the live-action one with the 3D lions. And it has this whole, like, father-son part of that movie, which I totally forgot. So it was a bit of an emotional day. And, you know, like, today, looking at it, like, I see my dad as somebody who's a different person. You know, he'd gotten therapy, he'd gotten all this help, he had tried to better himself, and so was I. And my parents had been there to support me when I needed help, when I was drinking and using. And I think that I've learned that part of making amends is that, like, if other people are to forgive me, I have to be willing to forgive them, too. And so, you know, not everyone in my family is quite as lovely to be around as my father is. Most of them have, like, drinking problems. And, you know, I made these amends, and I started to get into service, right? Step 12. I would pick up sponsees at meetings. I would always kind of, like, hold my hand like this. And if they ask for sponsors after this meeting, I'll probably still do that, even though, like, I'm the only guy at the podium talking. And I got a sponsee who actually stayed sober. And, you know, he wasn't like me at all. He was a contractor who had been shot multiple times, and he would tell me these, like, crazy violent stories, and his, like, daily life was, like, working out, like, building houses and decks and things like that. But, you know, I took him through the steps. We didn't have to have a lot in common. He's still a good friend of mine. And I have another sponsee now. And I realized that both of these men had been to prison. And this past year, I started doing, like, some of the corrections service work. And, you know, I had been dating this guy who was a firefighter this past year, and he kept telling me about this halfway house on Ponce where he was like, they just keep overdosing. He's like, I go there every week, and there's someone else is dead in a room. And he's like, I don't know what's going on there, but they just seem to OD. And I was like, well, yeah, that's like addiction, and like these are people who are struggling. And he wasn't really willing to hear that. But when I heard that they had an AA meeting there, I was like, well, I guess maybe I can go. And so I started going. And like I said before, I was told that your home group's where you are of service. So I just made a commitment to go once a week. You know, it's a different type of meeting than this. It's a different crew of people that are there. And I'm not there to really, like, save anyone's life. All I have to do is show up. And that, to me, is, like, a way to be of service. And I've learned with time that, like, service really isn't that hard. Like, you know, for some people, like, reading is, like, pretty easy, and they can do the readings at the beginning. Personally, I don't make coffee because I am terrible at it, and the grounds always end up in the cup. So, like, most home groups I've been in just know not to ask me to do that. I also hate being the chairperson because I hate reading the script, but if someone asks me to discussion lead, I have, like, a solid 5 topics from the big book that I'll just alternate through, and I'll say maybe something a little different every time, and so I never mind discussion leading. If you ever see me at a meeting, you can ask. And I think by being of service, it helps me stay sober, right? You hear that a lot. And it also gets me out of myself. I like to think about myself. I like to stare at myself in the mirror. I like to talk about myself. And I like to just, like, thrive in my own self-pity. And being sober, like, I don't have to be a victim anymore. You know, not everything is happening to me all the time. And sometimes it is happening to me, but it's probably happening to other people, too. I heard the term life on life's terms a lot when I got sober. And I would say that to myself a lot. It was probably my favorite saying, even though I hated it. Because I had these resentments against things like the weather, right? Like, I would just, like, be walking outside, and it would start raining, and I would be soaked. I thought, like, God was doing that to me. Like I said, I mean, I barely made it through chemistry class. And I had to learn that, you know, this is just life happening the way it wants to. And I can't control everything all the time. As I said before, like, not everybody was telling me in the meeting that I was going to make it. Which I've heard people say to others, and I was like, damn, where was that? And, but I remember, you've seen the custom where somebody picks up a year chip, and then they give it to a newcomer. And I was at a meeting, and this woman picked up a chip, and, like, she was kind of scary looking. She had this, like, Cleopatra haircut and a face tattoo, and, she introduced herself as Jen the Junkie. And I was like, my, like, mouth was probably hanging open. And she picked up a year chip, and then she, like, looked at me, and she was like, do you have a year? And I said, no, and she gave me her chip. And, you know, my parents didn't think I could stay sober. My old boyfriend didn't think I was going to stay sober. You know, I was told in a meeting that I probably shouldn't stay sober. But this one person believed in me. And I wasn't expecting that. I still have that blue chip. I actually have it with me right now because I thought maybe I'd get scared up here telling my story. And, you know, it took one person telling me that to know that maybe I could do it. And I just want you to know that if no one's told you today, like, you never have to drink again. Not everything I've done in these rooms has been, like, spiritually fit. My mother was just visiting over the weekend, and it was a nightmare. We just, like, argued the whole time. She, like, got out of the car last night and slammed the door and told me I was ungrateful. But, you know, and then I was talking to her today, and things were okay. She made it home safe on her flight. And, like, I know that with the tools that this program has given me, that I can maintain these relationships with my family members. You know, these are people who don't have a program. And I'm grateful every day that I do. I also know that by staying sober, it was my chance to live. You know, I said before that I had a friend who passed the day that I got sober. And a couple months after that, someone else from back home who I was friends with, he died from this disease. And then about the time I had 6 months, I had a friend who hung himself. And I started to, like, realize that, like, you know, the people I cared about were dying from this. And that I was really, really lucky to be here. I also, I didn't go back for any of their funerals because I knew I would just be seeing the same old neighborhoods and the same old people. And, you know, I knew that by staying here in Atlanta and by going to these meetings and working a program, that was the best thing I could do. Going to their funeral and getting wasted with my old friends wasn't going to help anybody. And, you know, for that, like, I'm still here today. And I'm a different person now. Like, I wake up before 11 a.m. I actually woke up at 5 today to go to the gym. And I go to Mass on Sundays, right? And, you know, when people call me now, I'm not afraid to pick up the phone. When my phone would ring, I always thought it was someone calling me to say that I robbed them or that they'd given me some type of STD. And, you know, that's just not the case. Now, a lot of times when I get a call from an unknown number, it's somebody from these rooms. And they call to say, hey, how are you? And I can say, like, oh, I'm fine. Or I can just, like, you know, rant and rave about how crazy my day's been. And I try to give my number out at meetings. I don't think you know who's going to be the person that's going to start calling you. I have a really good friend who, she's in her 50s, and she's an elementary school teacher, a preschool teacher, and she came into the rooms 2 years ago, and there weren't many people at this meeting. She was crying when she shared. It was, like, her second meeting. There was one other woman in the meeting who had, like, 30 days who went up to talk to her, and I was just like, oh, God, I guess I'll talk to this lady because I'm gay, and I'm, like, not going to creep on her. So I went up, and I gave her my number. And then she texted me, and I, sometimes when newcomers give me their number, I'll call them after a couple days, like, just to freak them out. It's like, nobody wants a phone call, especially when they're new in sobriety. And so I called her, and then she started calling me. And she'd ask how I'm doing. And that's how, you know, we make friends. Like, I used to make friends by, like, taking shots at a bar. And now I make phone calls where I ask a person a question and I listen. As I'm trying to listen in these rooms. And I think that without this program, I wouldn't be sober today. And I just had to do the basic things, and I still do the basic things. I go to meetings, I work the steps, I have a sponsor, I read the book, I still read the book. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. And I went to rehab not expecting to stay sober, but I'm just really glad it wasn't a spa when I showed up. So thanks for letting me share.
We've asked Lindsay to come up here and give out the chips. Thank you. That was great. That was amazing.
I'm Lindsay. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. At the Blue Chip Speakers meeting, we have a chip system to mark your time in sobriety. First chip we give out is the white chip for anyone that's coming back 24 hours. Silver chip for 30 days, bronze or whatever color this is, yellowish, for 60 days, red for 90, yellow for 6 months, green for 9 months, and then anyone celebrating years or multiple. Hi, I'm Lindsay.
Hi.
How'd you do it, and how many?
Crazy. I'm sick. How'd I do it the same way he said about the chips? I kept coming back. Well, not only that, the change of atmosphere, the people, and kind of have a made up mind. Just be willing. You know, one at a time. Like I said, it get hard at times, but if that other part of you say, you can go a little longer. Stick with that part. That other part might not make it. But it's been 11 months now. Wow.
12 months?
13 months.
Yeah, it was. So you have a year?
September, yeah.
You have a year?
Yeah, year and a month.
Year and a month. Good job. I'm going to give you your chip. This is Lisa. She's going to introduce herself, but I'm Lindsay again. When I met Lisa, I think it was probably at this meeting. It was like a year ago. I just loved her energy and the fact that she has so much love and kindness towards new people. And she does all the service that she does, and the amount of time she has amazes me. And the fact that she's my sponsor really helps, because she is a true inspiration to me. I do my best to do as much as I can. I know I can't do as much as she does yet, but she is definitely an inspiration to me, and I hope to be just like her one day. So I got her this very special chip, and thank you. You're welcome.
Oh, wow. Beautiful. I'm Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. And this meeting is really, really special to me. I may cry. I don't know how many months ago, my friend Bill, who used to share it, he was a sponsee of mine, and he relapsed. He's okay now. But he relapsed, and, like, it was like, oh, shit, they need a chairperson. Like, now. Because I said, well, you know, I may go support him, whatever. I don't know if I want to go to a speaker meeting. So I came, and it just touched me. And like you said, the thing about the newcomers. Oh, I have 29. Today I have 29 years. I started to get involved with some of the ladies here and friendly, you know, just friendly to the men and just making friends here. And I don't really understand what happened, but it just really fed my soul. And so I sponsor some ladies that are new from here, and I don't know. This is where my heart is. And I have a home group at 545, which is not really my home group, because this is where my heart is. Just been going through some stuff. I'm really passionate about service and helping people and not judging people, and fuck if you have teeth, or, you know, green hair, or I don't care where you're from, you know. I think everybody deserves a chance to get clean and sober, and I'm just really in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you.
So we have to offer the white tip one more time. Wow. Just in case someone missed it first time. Okay. Thank God for the chips that you hold.
Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
You ready, Bill?